Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. In Sudan, a year to the day after a military coup, pro-democracy protests, a crackdown, and resolve.
Despite the sort of signals of an impending violent response from the regime, what we have seen is a lot of people still go out into the streets.
Also today, Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro has a fierce campaigner making his case, his wife.
Uma guerra do bem contra o mal.
First Lady Michelle Bolsonaro says this weekend's presidential election is nothing less than a war of good versus evil. Plus, the latest occupant at 10 Downing Street moves in. New Prime Minister Rishi Sunak does not mince words.
Right now, our country is facing a profound economic crisis.
I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We start today in London, where 10 Downing Street has another new occupant. Rishi Sunak met this morning with King Charles at Buckingham Palace, where the monarch invited him to form a new government, making Rishi Sunak's selection as Britain's new prime minister official. If you've lost count, he is the fifth leader of the United Kingdom in the past 6 years. To put it mildly, Sunak is taking over at a challenging time. Our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has more.
It's usually a big day of pomp and celebration when a new prime minister takes over. But Rishi Sunak's first day in the job was decidedly low-key. After meeting the king, Sunak took to the podium outside the prime minister's official residence, and he addressed the nation with some straight talk.
Right now, our country is facing a profound economic crisis. The aftermath of COVID still lingers. Putin's war in Ukraine has destabilized energy markets and supply chains the world over.
It all stood in pretty stark contrast to Boris Johnson on his first day in office just 3 years ago.
It is time to change the record, to recover our natural and historic role as an enterprising, outward-looking and truly global Britain.
Rishi Sunak appears so keen to show everyone that he's serious about his new job that he stood alone at that podium without the usual gaggle of aides or even family members by his side to cheer him on. The new Prime Minister told the British public that things are going to be different under his leadership.
This government will have integrity, professionalism and accountability at every level.
That sounded like a veiled swipe at his predecessors. Boris Johnson's premiership was dogged by personal scandals, while Liz Truss's 44 days in office were accompanied by economic chaos. The new prime minister then got down to the business of picking his top team, sacking some of those who were openly disloyal to him recently, and rewarding others who stood by his side. Leaders around the world have been congratulating Sunak. President Joe Biden mentioned his appointment during the Diwali celebrations in the White House yesterday. Sunak's family are from India, but Biden didn't quite get the new British leader's name right.
And whether it's the United Kingdom or just today, we've got news that Rishi Sunak is now the Prime Minister. As my brother would say, go figure.
Best wishes came in too from Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky and the French President Emmanuel Macron. Back in the UK, opposition politicians and some members of the public are still calling for a general election. They say the new Prime Minister doesn't have a mandate from the people to lead the country. But some, like Conservative lawmaker Hugh Merriman, are just hoping for a little less drama.
We don't want any excitement. We don't want any more turbulence. In a sense, we might be more boring as a government, but actually I think that's what people want. We've had enough excitement.
After all, there is a cost of living crisis and Britain appears to be heading towards recession. One sign of optimism this afternoon, though, after Rishi Sunak's speech, the British pound rose to its highest level against the dollar in weeks. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
This weekend, Brazilians will go to the ballot box again to elect their next president. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, a leftist, is up roughly 7 points over far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. One person fighting hard to close that gap is First Lady Michelle Bolsonaro. She's a devout evangelical. In recent weeks, she's been holding rallies across Brazil, trying to shore up votes, especially from women and devout Christians. From southern Brazil, reporter Michael Fox has our story.
Dozens of women chant outside the Moor of Christ Church in Florianópolis in support of their president, Jair Bolsonaro. They wear yellow and green, the colors of Brazil, Bolsonaro's colors. They are ecstatic. First Lady Michele Bolsonaro is in town. We came from far away, says supporter Rosana Bauer. She wears a huge Brazilian flag draped around her body. We're here for Bolsonaro and Michele. Michele is a marvelous woman, a religious woman, and we're here to fill her with love and strength because we're going to win this election, she says. Hundreds of women crowd into the already packed hall. On the stage, a huge screen reads, Women with Bolsonaro. Michele Bolsonaro has been traveling up and down Brazil with an entourage of allied congresswomen and female politicians. They've met with thousands of women in each city, and they've praised Bolsonaro's fight for so-called conservative family values. On stage, First Lady Michele Bolsonaro is natural, charismatic and friendly. She's also very clear about what's at stake. We are at war, she says. A war of good versus evil. We will say no to abortion, no to the legalization of drugs, no to gender ideology. That language resonates. This is a revolution, says 30-year-old Suzanne Siqueira outside the church. Like it or not, this is a spiritual war, good versus evil. I really believe that, she says. And that's why we're here for Bolsonaro. That religious language has been a key Bolsonaro strategy to win over the faithful despite financial hard times and rising poverty. And as the campaigns have intensified ahead of this weekend's vote, Michele Bolsonaro has become a shining ambassador of Bolsonaro's message.
A Michele Bolsonaro é uma figura-chave. E o discurso dela nos últimos...
Michele Bolsonaro is really important, says anthropologist Vinicius Dovalli. Her discourse has been, don't look at my husband, look at me. You'll be voting for me and what I represent. This has been the message at many churches here recently, he says.
O inferno não tem como entrar no lugar santo. Aqui é santo. Aleluia.
Pentecostal pastors across Brazil have attacked former President Lula and urged their congregations to back Bolsonaro in this weekend's elections. The political campaigning from the pulpit has been constant in recent months. It's also led some people to leave their churches. Earlier this month, indigenous leader Gianni Monapei gave me a tour of her Satire Mauê neighborhood on the outskirts of Manaus. She introduced me to her aunt, who lives in a hillside cinder block home. She left her prayer circle because instead of talking about Jesus, they were only discussing politics, Monapei told me. Roughly half of evangelicals back Bolsonaro, compared with a third for former President Lula, according to a recent poll. But Lula has been working hard to win over the faithful. Last week, he met with evangelical leaders in São Paulo.
Pai querido, eu peço nesse momento, Senhor, para você estar abençoando o presidente Lula.
There, he delivered a letter to the evangelical community responding to the disinformation campaign against him, which accused him of wanting to close churches and legalize abortion and pedophilia.
A família para mim é uma coisa sagrada. Eu sou daquele que todo final de semana.
For me, family is sacred, he told them. He said he was personally against abortion and called the fake news attacks on him a sad scandal that faith was being used for electoral means. The evangelical vote will be key in this weekend's election. Evangelicals now make up roughly a third of Brazilians. Regardless of the outcome of the presidential vote, it's a sign of the power of evangelicals in Brazil, which will likely only grow in the coming years. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
The U.S. government has a message for China, enough with the spying. Yesterday, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland told reporters about three investigations into Chinese intelligence activities in the U.S.
As these cases demonstrate, the government of China sought to interfere with the rights and freedoms of individuals in the United States and to undermine our judicial system that protects those rights. They did not succeed.
We wanted to know how widespread the influence of Chinese intelligence is here in the U.S. We reached out to Tung Biao, a Chinese human rights lawyer in New Jersey. He's now a visiting professor at several universities in the U.S.
Yeah, it's a serious problem. Chinese government has been spying the United States and other free countries for a long, long time. And they sent professional spies as well as like a plainclothes monitors, informants. It's really rampant.
What have you heard from Chinese nationals in the U.S., whether academics or students, about the reach of Chinese intelligence in this country?
Chinese scholars and the students and other Chinese people in the diaspora community often are monitored by the Chinese associations, like on campus, the Students and the Scholars Associations, CSSA. So they can monitor the speech and activities of the Chinese people living in the United States and report them to Chinese consulate or government if they are involving in critical comments or activities.
And what happens if the subjects of that espionage, if they don't self-censor or if they don't pull back?
Yeah, if we don't self-censor and then when we get back to China to get a job or to visit our families and relatives in China, we will have trouble. And most importantly, the family members and relatives of the overseas dissidents, overseas critics, will have trouble. So it's kind of a collective punishment. Mm. And there are cases that parents or siblings of overseas dissidents were arrested and convicted.
What is your own experience, Tung Biao, with this system by which Chinese academics in the U.S. are monitored and spied upon? Has it gotten intimidating for you?
Yeah, I have several personal experiences. Like my scheduled talk was canceled by universities because my talk will be very critical. Mm. And I often received warnings seeing that my computer, my cell phone, these are Chinese government-backed hacking attempts. And I also received death threat from social media, from Chinese government social media users.
What kind of message will these Justice Department investigations send to Beijing? Will China rethink this secret, not-so-secret espionage strategy?
It's important to investigate and scrutinize the companies closely connected to Chinese authorities. But the Chinese government, Chinese Communist Party, will not change their policy to continue to spy on American technology, American politics. And they will send more spies and they will spend more money on spying.
Instead of pulling back, you think they'll go deeper with the spying?
Right. They will go deeper and they will go more skillfully.
Tung Biao is Chinese and was a human rights lawyer when he lived in China. He now lives in New Jersey and teaches at Hunter College in New York. He was helping us to understand the impact of the Justice Department's investigation into spying by the Chinese government. Tung Biao, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, despite challenges, the democracy movement hangs on in Sudan 1 year after a military coup there. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's been exactly 1 year since the military staged a coup in Sudan. That shattered hopes for democracy on the part of many Sudanese. Today, though, protesters came together for a march on the presidential palace in the capital, Khartoum. Videos posted on social media showed demonstrators waving flags and beating drums. There have also been reports of the authorities responding with tear gas. The internet has been blocked in Sudan, and the Associated Press has been unable to verify exactly what's happening there today. Joining us now is Holud Khayr. She's the founding director of Confluence Advisory, a think tank based in Khartoum. She joins us today from the Moroccan city of Tangier. Khaled, we want to hear your thoughts on how Sudan might return to some form of democracy. But first, the news today. I mean, despite the internet blackout, have you been able to get any news today from friends, family, colleagues in Sudan? And what have you heard about the protests and the mood there on this anniversary?
Yes, I think people were quite worried when last night the bridges were closed by their regime. And then this morning, everyone woke up to 40% to zero internet connectivity. And that gave a sense of a prelude to a lot of regime violence today, because that has been the theme throughout successive protests since last year's coup. It was very reminiscent of the revolution that unseated Bashir several years ago. And I think to some extent that worry was justified, because we have heard that some people have been injured, potentially also killed. We're not sure yet of what the scale of that is. And again, only because now the internet connectivity is slowly returning, will we get a sense of how bad the protests were in terms of state repression and response. I think is worthwhile mentioning is that despite the signals, even from last night, of an impending violent response from the regime, what we have seen is a lot of people still go out into the street. And I think a year on after the coup, it just shows how much momentum is still there among Sudan's pro-democracy movement.
Right. And of course, Bashir is Omar al-Bashir, the former dictator of Sudan. Khaled, I'm just curious, how effective has the military been over the past year at running Sudan?
Quite frankly, not very effective at all. You could say that the military has run Sudan into the ground. Since last year's coup, inflation has gone through the roof and has only recently gone down. And that's mostly because Sudan is in recession, not because of governmental policies. The conflicts around the country have increased exponentially, most recently in Blue Nile State, where 200 people were killed in the last week. That is a direct result of the military's lack of intervention in some areas and direct intervention in others. So the entirety of, you know, people's living standards have also been lowered drastically. Mm. There are a lot of people going hungry. Food insecurity has also, of course, gone through the roof, like it has in other parts of the Horn and North Africa, in part due to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but also due to domestic issues, in that the government current is not equipped to govern. It is merely equipped to retain power.
Now, this summer, the coup leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, said he supported a transition to civilian rule. So what roadblocks are there to a civilian government and free elections at this point?
Well, the irony is that General Burhan may have said that he was willing to hand over power to the civilian government, but he and his allies remain the biggest hurdle towards that civilian transfer of power and indeed credible election, not to mention the Bashir's 2010 elections law, the National Elections Commission, which is still very much a product of the Bashir era. You have the gerrymandering of constituency boundaries. You have the electoral register that is mostly registering Islamist voters. All of that providing elections architecture that is designed to bring about a victory for the Islamists supported by the military. So under the current circumstances, and unless there is genuine reform of electoral processes, we will not be able to get any kind of free and fair election in the future.
Has there been any kind of international pressure put on the military in Sudan to allow for truly independent elections?
Yes, at the time of the coup itself last year, we saw an immediate and very strong response from the international community at all levels. We saw, for example, the African Union suspend Sudan, and we saw the United Nations and several bilateral countries condemn the coup in the strongest terms. Now, interestingly, the US has not designated Sudan's coup as a coup. It prefers to call it a military takeover. They say this is for legal reasons. Once it is designated as a coup by the State Department, there'll be legal impediments to provide any sort of support to Sudan. And so what we have is an international community that to some extent recognizes that this is an unconstitutional change in government, but has been very slow to provide the kind of support that pro-democracy actors need in order to push for that civilian democratic government that we all want to see.
What about the power of an NGO like yours, Confluence Advisory? I mean, you call yourselves, interestingly, not just a think tank, but a think and do tank. What are you and other civil society organizations able to do to move the needle influencing the generals? Is there any room for dialogue?
None whatsoever. I mean, there is an issue here, which is that most think tanks that work in the civil society space wouldn't necessarily want to engage with the generals, because as we have seen in previous Catholic experiences, they will be used by the general to sort of promote this idea that they are reaching out to think tanks, to civil society groups, but only effectively to be used to sort of whitewash their image and play at doing governance. But we know from the experience in the past year that they're not, their primary priority is not actually to govern, it is merely to survive.
I'm just curious, Khulod, what was your sense a year ago when this coup happened about how long it would take before things could get right again?
So we don't, unfortunately, have a very good history here. The first successful coup that took place in Sudan's independent history lasted for 9 years, the second for 16, and the third for 29, almost 30 years. So what we're seeing is that exponentially. Now, what's different this time and what gives me hope is that the pro-democracy movement in Sudan has also developed and learned from previous experiences. And so what we've seen is that there's a move towards building a new political imagination in Sudan, one that moves away from the militarization of Sudanese politics and the dominance of political parties that haven't really been able to muster the kind of political opposition that is required to unseat the military governments from power. And so that shift is very interesting, and it also provides a great deal of hope and should be supported in order to fully bring about those kinds of political changes that are needed to make sure that coups don't continue to happen.
Khulod Khayr is the founding director of Confluence Advisory, based in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Khulod joined us from Tangier in Morocco. Thank you very much for your time today, Khulod.
Thank you very much.
American basketball star Brittany Griner remains in a Russian prison today. This morning in Moscow, a court rejected her appeal of a 9-year prison sentence. Griner was convicted in August for drug possession. Police say they found vape canisters containing cannabis oil in her luggage at a Moscow airport last winter. The U.S. government has said Griner was wrongfully detained. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said today's decision in Moscow was, quote, another failure of justice compounding the injustice of her detention. Griner is a 2-time Olympic gold medalist and 8-time All-Star with the WNBA's Phoenix Mercury. The WNBA Players Association said today after the ruling that Griner is very clearly a hostage. The U.S. has signaled its willingness to negotiate a prisoner swap with Russia. Today's rejection of Griner's appeal could move the needle closer to that step. More news from around the globe is still ahead. You're listening to The World. He was once the biggest opera star in Belarus. Then he brought his voice to the protest movement there and sang an updated version of a song of independence from 1942.
It's considered as a threat nowadays for officials.
Singing it is partly why he had to leave Belarus. His story and his music still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Israeli forces raided several areas in the occupied West Bank in the pre-dawn hours this morning. At least 6 Palestinians were reportedly killed. Israel's security forces were targeting a Palestinian armed group in the city of Nablus. With us now for the latest on the raid is Fatima Abdelkarim. She's a Palestinian reporter based in the West Bank. Fatima, what happened last night in Nablus?
As you have mentioned, Marco, 5 Palestinians were killed in Nablus and a 6th one was killed in a village near Ramallah when Israeli forces raided the city that was already sealed off for about 15 days. The Israeli raid targeted specifically a militant hideout or a house of one of the militants. It said it was after. They said that the hideout was used as an IED workshop. Palestinians on the ground said it was unlikely because it was a residential home.
This group that the Israeli security forces targeted, it calls itself the Lion's Den. Are they affiliated with any Palestinian political group?
This is a group of militants who come from different backgrounds, meaning different political colors and belonging to different factions, political factions, including Fatah, the ruling party, left-wing PFLP, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and as well as Hamas and others. This group of young men say they are unaffiliated with any of these political parties. They are working on their own or together, basically, to defend their city.
So where does Lion's Den get its support?
This is a very tricky question. It's hard to know where exactly they get their support. But the words from the street and from other PA, Palestinian Authority security sources, and Israeli sources say it might be funded financially through right-wing Islamic parties like Hamas and Islamic Jihad. However, they don't seem to be receiving political directives directly at the moment from these groups.
During this raid in Nablus, during this Israeli security raid in Nablus, was the Palestinian Authority present at all? Were they trying to calm things down?
The Palestinian Authority is usually informed of any Israeli security incursion or Israeli security operation or activity inside any Palestinian area that is under their control, such as the city center of Nablus. However, what happened last night, according to witnesses and according to PA security forces, is that they were surprised to see a small unit of undercover Israeli forces entering into the city without coordination. Due to this, there was a short period of time where the Palestinian security forces clashed with this undercover group because they were armed and in the middle of the city center of Nablus. Naturally, clashes did occur, but it ended quickly as soon as the PA forces had to withdraw, apparently, and Israeli forces advanced.
So heading into the future, do you think the Palestinian Authority can and will work to restore stability in Nablus? Is there a role for them to play? And do Palestinians locally want them there?
Many Palestinians say that in terms of security and stability, the PA is very much capable of restoring calm, relative stability despite its unpopularity, but because of its strong security bodies. But at the same time, this all is limited to anything but the interference of Israeli forces in any domain.
So as you know, Fatima, there's a national election in Israel next week. Some Israeli conservative lawmakers are saying Prime Minister Yair Lapid is not doing enough to bolster Israeli security. What's the prognosis for more Israeli military raids in the West Bank in the coming days?
To the way the Palestinians see it on the ground, it's not just this raid or the latest crackdown on the two northern West Bank cities, Jenin and Nablus. It's Palestinians describe it in a way that it includes a systematic type of restrictions, sometimes oppression, and especially, of course, the lack of safety because of the repeated Israeli killings and likewise the Palestinian shootings, shooting attacks and stabbing attempts are met with a heavy, excessive use of force that even includes settler attacks that are happening across the West Bank in a frequency that is also the highest in about 6 or 7 years.
Fatima Abdel Karim is a Palestinian reporter based in the West Bank. She joined us from Ramallah. Fatima, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Polio is a life-threatening virus that attacks the brain and can leave people in a state of paralysis. It had been severely reduced in many parts of the world. An outbreak in New York State last summer now has the CDC considering using an oral polio vaccine for the first time in 20 years. Ukraine has also been fighting a polio outbreak. Just days before the Russian invasion, officials in Ukraine launched a national campaign to vaccinate children against polio. But as Levi Bridges reports, the war is disrupting the public health effort.
At a hospital in western Ukraine, children are getting an oral polio vaccine. In this video shown on Ukrainian TV, a health official tips a little girl's head back and drops the vaccine right in her mouth. It's over in about 3 seconds. Oral polio vaccines contain a weakened strain of the virus. And in rare instances, when you have lots of unvaccinated people, the weakened virus in the vaccine can mutate and start circulating, causing a polio outbreak. As a side note, this happens with the oral vaccine, which they currently don't use in the U.S. But last fall, two unvaccinated children in Ukraine got polio that way and became paralyzed. The kids came from different regions of Ukraine that don't even border each other. With polio, that's a very big deal.
A single case is considered an outbreak.
Raymond Dankley is the World Health Organization's polio outbreak response coordinator in Ukraine. He says one case of polio matters, not just because polio is super contagious, but because it's a disease that has been targeted for global eradication. Unlike COVID, polio could vanish completely if enough people got vaccinated. The war in Ukraine has made controlling the outbreak there much harder. For one, there's just logistics. Healthcare facilities are getting blown up.
So with hospitals being destroyed, repositioning those vaccines closer to the people becomes also a challenge.
And millions of Ukrainians are on the move, fleeing for safety in other countries or internally within Ukraine. Dunkley says that mass migration could spread polio further.
One challenging thing about polio is the fact that 90% are asymptomatic carriers. These are individuals that will not come down with paralysis, but they may have the virus and they can transmit and they can shed the virus.
A lot of those Ukrainians who fled home with their kids could get them vaccinated elsewhere. But Pavlo Kovtanuk, the former deputy health minister of Ukraine, says people put it off.
And the main reason is that when they migrate, it's not that, you know, I moved and I settled down and I found a school and I found a doctor. No, they live somewhere temporarily. And in healthcare, the attitude of people is, let's wait until we come home and we will go to our doctor. They just postpone receiving care.
Even before the war, not enough Ukrainians were getting vaccinated for polio. But Kovtanyuk says recent healthcare reforms helped to make huge advances in fighting vaccine hesitancy. In just a few years, polio vaccinations in Ukraine increased from 60 to 80%. But those gains started decreasing slightly during the pandemic. One reason might be Russian propaganda about COVID vaccines. Lubomir Muisev, the deputy director of the Ukrainian research group Rating, says Russian propaganda convinced some Russian speakers in Ukraine that Russian vaccines against COVID are safer than Western ones. Muisev says it's hard not to succumb to this propaganda because it plays into people's fears, not just about the COVID vaccine, but vaccines in general, including polio. As the war continues, international organizations try to educate Ukrainians about the importance of getting the polio vaccine. A video in Ukrainian, released last year by UNICEF, shows children, freshly vaxxed, who suddenly get superpowers. They shoot fireballs from their fists at a giant spider-like creature who looks exactly like one of the monsters in the Netflix hit Stranger Things. Despite these efforts, the current estimate of Ukrainian babies who get vaccinated against polio this year fell to less than 50%, which means, so far, the war has erased the huge gains that were made in stopping the spread of polio in Ukraine. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges.
The Biden administration is tightening the screws on Nicaragua's authoritarian government by going after its lucrative gold industry. President Biden signed an executive order this week, making it all but illegal for Americans to do business with Nicaragua's gold sector. The order also freezes the assets of a key Nicaraguan government advisor and revokes the U.S. visas of others close to the country's president, Daniel Ortega. Ricardo Zuniga is the State Department Special Envoy for Central America. Assistant Secretary Zuniga, tell us more about these sanctions. What is the goal and how will you know if they've been successful?
The goal here really is to encourage the Ortega-Murillo regime to negotiate in good faith regarding really the retreat in human rights conditions and the fact that they've taken Nicaragua from a democracy that was problematic to an authoritarian state. And they have not opted to negotiate either internally or with the very large segment of the international community that believes they're taking Nicaragua on the very wrong path.
And why the focus on gold? How will restrictions on this commodity change things?
Our focus really has been on trying to have sanctions that impact directly those who are either making money off of particular industries, and gold is one of the ones that has flowed money into the coffers, not just of Daniel Ortega and his family, but the supporters that he needs to help keep him in power and consolidate centralized rule in Nicaragua. So this industry in particular has been vulnerable to that sort of abuse.
Is gold especially significant as a commodity in Nicaragua?
It is. It's worth about $1 billion in sales, and about 3/4 of that those sales have come to the United States previously. So that was something that was increasingly important as a source of revenue for regime insiders.
Yeah, Assistant Secretary, earlier you referred to the regime in Nicaragua as the Ortega Murillo regime because the president's wife, Rosario Murillo, is a key government leader. Will this have any direct impact on those two people? What is their direct interest in gold?
We certainly believe it will have a direct impact on them because they have personally benefited, not just themselves, but their close allies are paid out of profits from this sector. I should say that the amendments to the executive order permit the U.S. government to look at other sectors as well. But again, we've tried to keep this as narrowly focused as we can on those who are committing abuses and those who are involved in financing the abuses by Daniel Ortega and Vice President Murillo.
There is a counterproductive possibility that some are concerned with. Squeezing Nicaragua's economy could hurt ordinary Nicaraguans and force more to try and migrate potentially to the U.S., something Washington has tried to address at the retail level with leaders across Latin America. How concerned are you by that?
This is not a sector that employs a large number of Nicaraguans. That is something that was important to our considerations. But at the same time, we are very cognizant of the fact that this really immense level of repression that they're exercising, not just against the private sector, but also against religious organizations and anyone who is in opposition to the government, is the greatest factor in driving out migration from Nicaragua.
Who are the U.S. partners today in Central America?
Well, look, this is in diplomacy, that's often very complex, but we have excellent relationships, for example, with Panama and Costa Rica. We have very good relationships with Honduras and with others as well, the Belize certainly. And we have relations as well with Guatemala and El Salvador, but they are all subject, of course, to the complexities of the kind of relationship where you have very large populations of many of those countries in the United States. So that requires a close relationship. We do have concerns on governance. We've seen some worsening conditions in several countries. And part of what we're doing here is making sure that we signal that the direction that Nicaragua has taken is something that the United States will respond to. So we also want to discourage the kinds of activities that, unfortunately, Nicaragua has chosen to inflict on its own population.
So as to Nicaragua, the president, Daniel Ortega, has jailed more than 40 opposition figures, including 7 presidential challengers. If Ortega were to go away tomorrow, do you see a legitimate post-Ortega leadership waiting somewhere in the wings?
You really can't underestimate the institutional damage that Ortega and Murillo have inflicted on Nicaragua. Yet we deal in trying to find solutions to difficult problems like this. It's very important that the will of the Nicaraguan people be respected, that their sovereignty be allowed to be exercised and not determined by 2 people, by 1 family, or by the family and allies such as Russia. It's really important for us to make sure that we are there to support those actors who want to return democratic institutions to their place in Nicaraguan society. It is a society that wants democracy, that has actively fought for democracy and tried to accomplish it under very difficult conditions. And it's very clear that the rest of the region wants Nicaragua, particularly Ortega Murillo, to meet Nicaragua's commitments under the Inter-American Democratic Charter.
Ricardo Zuniga is the U.S. State Department's Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs. Assistant Secretary Zuniga, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Marco.
The college tour is considered by some high school seniors and their parents to be a rite of passage, but taking a week-long trip to visit school campuses is not something every family can afford. Like everything else, those visits are going virtual, and many are now in Spanish. For this story and others in our series about immigration and higher education, go to our website, theworld.org, and click On Course. That rich baritone is the voice of Ilya Silchikov. He was the lead soloist of the State Opera Bolshoi in Minsk, the capital of Belarus. That job ended after he added his voice to nationwide anger over longtime Belarusian strongman Alexander Lukashenko. Protesters called for Lukashenko to step down following his controversial re-election to a sixth term in office in 2020. The government cracked down with arrests, torture, and imprisonments. Ilya Silchukov joins us in our Boston studio. So I want to know more about the protests and why you left Belarus. But first, let's talk about better times, if we can, when you had a place to practice your art. Can I assume that for a young opera singer, it was real prestige to be singing with the Belarusian State Opera?
Yeah, of course, because we have only one theater in Belarus, and it's only in the capital city in Minsk. And it's a pretty big company with over 1,500 employees there and big ensembles of singers that work there. And of course, your native city and your native theater is always remains in your heart, and it's like your motherland.
Listeners will recall the protests in Minsk in 2020, an election that was widely seen in Belarus and beyond as fraudulent and bringing Alexander Lukashenko back to power again. What went through your mind as authorities responded to the protests with violence?
I think the most of the artists of Belarus, as we feel more responsibility for the processes that are going in our society and for a moral response for that, I thought it was inevitable for me to say that I'm against that. It was blackout of internet after the elections and after the protests on the street. The first day, we've got none of information for 3 days in a row.
There was a news blackout.
Yeah. And they did it purposely so people would not know what's going on in the country.
Were you in the streets protesting as well?
I was on the streets end of August till end of November. Every Sunday we were on the streets.
Well, I'd like us to hear some more of your singing, not in an opera context, though. This is part of a music video that featured your voice.
Могутний Боже, владар сусвєта.
So when I say music video, let me be clear about what we're seeing in this video. The footage begins with a drone shot over a massive street protest in Minsk. Then we see images of police violence. A protester gets shot in the chest. The video dramatizes that moment with a choreographed killing, almost dance-like, as an actor falls to the ground in a meadow. All of that while you are singing, with a chorus of Belarusians all dressed in white, striding in that meadow. This is really a powerful video. Tell us about the song, Almighty God, and why it's important.
This is an official hymn of independent Belarus. It was written back in 1942 under occupation of German forces.
Mm. And in the context of the opposition to President Alexander Lukashenko these days, what does this video mean?
It means that this is the prayer for Belarus, for the better future and independence. And though it's written in Belarusian language and it tells about our history and about our future and our hopes, it's considered as a threat nowadays for officials.
So a very meaningful song.
It's a song of resistance and peaceful resistance, and it was our and mine and my friend's artistic response for what I've saw on streets, because we felt, you know, there is a term in Greek, kairos, the specific time that comes, and we need to do something about that.
And just to be clear, Ilya, you produced this when you were still in Belarus, right?
It was the middle of September.
2020? Just a month after the election.
Yes, and after I was fired, the next day we published this video as my response for that.
I'm speaking with Ilya Silchukov, former star of the State Opera in Belarus, who joined the protests against President Alexander Lukashenko that began in 2020. So what prompted you and your family to finally leave Belarus?
my main engagements were in Europe, so I could work there. But I was afraid that it will come a moment that I won't be able to cross the border and I will be limited with traveling.
Right.
So we realized that we need to pack, and my wife, she was called maybe twice or three times to the KGB office.
Mm.
You understand that it was caused by my position as an activist and for human rights and so on. So we realized that we need to leave the country as fast as we can.
Ilya, you came to the U.S. this year. What do you miss most about Belarus, either the country itself or the work that you were noted for there?
I miss my friends and my family, the rest of my family. And of course, I miss my theater, and I miss the opportunities that we lose due to a regime that keeps people continuously in threat, and people are so stressed, you know.
Mm. Do you think about what ifs? Like, what if Lukashenko had agreed that he was defeated, as most countries view the results of the 2020 election there?
Yeah.
And how your life would be different?
You never know, but we have what we have, and it's hard to guess, But I'm enjoying the current moment, and even in the midst of such a despair, you see the reaction of hundreds and thousands of Belarusians, and the support of the societies here in the United States of Free Belarus, and it inspires.
Singer Ilya Silchukov, thank you very much for telling us your story.
Thank you, Marco.
Мова родная моя, слови осолода. Без тебе хто был бы я, что было б з народом.
Baritone Ilya Silchukov lives and teaches in Massachusetts. He performs in the U.S. and across Europe, but not in Belarus. His version of the Belarusian song Moa brings our program to a close. The World comes to you each day from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.